And the feds are listening to us as we continue to place well-qualified Alaskans into the highest levels of the federal government.
Senator Sullivan highlights Alaska's increased national presence in his address to the legislature. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, February 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, roaring waves take the place of sea ice in western Alaska.
Everybody in the community is like, it's February. We shouldn't be hearing ocean waves crashing on the beach.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you.
Senator Dan Sullivan said in his annual address to the state legislature this morning that he doesn't always like President Trump's tweets, but he likes what the Trump administration is doing for Alaska. During the 2016 presidential election, Sullivan called on Trump to step down as the Republican nominee after the Access Hollywood tape became public. But as Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports, there's not a lot of daylight between them now when you look at the senator's voting record.
Sullivan says the annual speech in the State House chamber is an opportunity to step back and look at the big picture. Barely 2 minutes in, he made the rhetorical equivalent of an eye roll.
Being in elected office, we can get caught up in the news of the day, sometimes as a result of an intemperate tweet or two, or three, or four.
Whatever their differences, Sullivan and Trump are alike on many policies. According to the data crunchers at the website 538, Sullivan's votes agree with Trump's position more than 95% of the time. In his speech, Sullivan made it clear he's embracing what Trump does, at least for Alaska. As for what the president says, Sullivan is keeping some distance.
I disagree with a number of statements and tweets made by President Trump, but in terms of a federal government that is finally working to help us grow our economy, we are making significant progress.
He cited new opportunities for oil development, the president's support for a King Cove Road, and progress on the gas line.
And the feds are listening to us as we continue to place well-qualified Alaskans into the highest levels of the federal government.
Sullivan named five Alaskans working in the Trump administration. Joe Balash is at the Interior Department in charge of oil and gas on federal lands. Chris Oliver oversees federal fisheries at NOAA. Drew Pierce is at the Transportation Department. Chris Laddick is the EPA Administrator for Alaska and the Northwest. And Tara Sweeney has been selected to be Assistant Interior Secretary for Indian Affairs. Sullivan says the Trump appointees will protect Alaska's interests. On gun control, Sullivan says he'll evaluate proposals arising out of the latest school shooting.
However, as Alaskans, we understand how important our Second Amendment rights are. We use firearms not only for self-defense, but as a tool to feed our families.
At a press conference afterward, Sullivan said he has serious doubts about President Trump's proposal to raise the age limit for guns to 21.
I mean, to me, that would not work in Alaska.
He says the problem of school violence should be considered more broadly.
Are we poisoning the minds of our children by having them watch movies and video games that glorify killing people? I mean, just turn on any movie. Those didn't exist 20 or 30 years ago.
Sullivan says he knows wading into cultural issues could make him vulnerable for ridicule. He says he doesn't want to become the new Tipper Gore. She was mocked in the 80s for campaigning to get warning stickers on albums with profane lyrics. Senator Berta Gardner, a Democrat from Anchorage, said she liked Sullivan's address, but wished he'd talked about getting revenue sharing for Alaska from offshore drilling and that he'd said more about advancing the gas line. For Alaska Public Media, I'm Liz Ruskin.
More than 20,000 Alaskans are waiting for their applications for assistance through health and social services to be processed by the state government. The House Finance Committee voted today in favor of hiring 41 additional people to reduce the backlog. The extra hires would cost slightly more than $2 million, matched by an equal amount of federal money. Anchorage Democratic Representative Les Guerra supported an amendment to add the money. He says Division of Public Assistance staff are overworked.
The morale in that department is not good. These are people hired because they want to help people, and they're instead being burnt out.
But Wasilla Republican Representative Kathy Tilton opposed the amendment. She notes the department already has unfilled positions.
If we keep throwing money at it without a plan in place of how we're actually going to reduce that backlog, I think it's kind of like doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results.
The backlog fell from a high of more than 27,000 people in June to a low of 15,000 in December, but it's risen sharply in the last 2 months. Most of the applicants are seeking Medicaid, but the backlog also includes people seeking food stamps and other income-based assistance. The committee voted 6-5 to pass the amendment. The five Democrats on the committee and Ketchikan Independent Dan Ortez voted for the amendment. The committee's four Republicans and Anchorage Independent Jason Gren voted against it. The funding proposal still faces votes on the House floor and in the Senate. Speaking at a conference in Juneau last week, Alaska Congressman Don Young argued against gun control by suggesting Jews might not have died in the Holocaust if they had been armed.
How many millions of people were shot and killed because they were unarmed? 50 million in Russia because their citizens weren't armed. How many Jews were put into the ovens because they were unarmed?
The recording was provided by Dimitri Shane, an Anchorage Democrat who is running for Young's seat. Shane was in the audience for Young's speech to the Alaska Municipal League, and he asked Young about school safety, which prompted Young to bring up the Holocaust. The argument that gun control allowed the rise of Hitler has circulated among gun rights advocates for years. Here's CNN's Wolf Blitzer challenging then-presidential candidate Ben Carson about it in 2015.
So what is the point you're trying to make? If there had been guns in Germany, there might not have been a Holocaust?
My point is, that was only one of the countries that I mentioned. There were a number of countries where tyranny reigned, and before it happened, they disarmed the people. That was the point.
A 1938 Nazi law prohibited Jews from owning weapons, but there were numerous instances of armed Jewish resistance during the war. The Anti-Defamation League says it's ludicrous to claim Germany's Jews could have stopped the Third Reich with personal firearms. Congressman Young is a longtime board member of the National Rifle Association. He said last week he favors allowing teachers to carry firearms. He points to video games and the breakdown of families as possible causes of school violence. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, as PyeongChang events subside, young athletes high kick their way through the Native Youth Olympics.
At a young age, you get them interested and it kind of motivates them to get better in all these events and maybe even go through high school.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside of Alaska, and it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
Temperatures in parts of Alaska reached more than 40 degrees above normal this month, and sea ice cover in the Bering Sea has dropped to levels never before recorded. Social media across western Alaska lit up as residents posted photos and videos of open water where there should be ice. As Rachel Waldholtz from Alaska's Energy Desk reports, in some communities, people say it's the first time they can remember seeing wide open water in February.
One video from the tiny island village of Diomede in the middle of the Bering Strait has gotten national attention. In it, you can hear people react as they watch giant waves crash onto shore and surge between buildings during a storm. Beyond the waves, open water, as far as the eye can see. And that is not the way it's supposed to be. Francis Ozena is the tribal coordinator in Diomede.
This is really amazing to see this change. I don't think anybody was really expecting this to happen.
Ozena says it's the first time she can remember ever seeing totally open water in front of Diomede this time of year. She says normally the ice grows from January all the way through March. But this year, it's been unpredictable, moving every day with water opening and closing. Then on February 20th, a major storm blew away what ice they did have and left the village without protection from the waves. The storm flooded Diomede's water treatment plant and knocked out power to some homes. Chunks of ice and debris were tossed onto the beach and the village's helicopter pad. Ozena says nothing about this weather is normal.
It's very odd. This is supposed to be the coldest time of the year. So we always have ice closure.
And it's not just Diomede.
Particularly out in the Bering Sea, we're seeing record low levels of sea ice.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist based in Anchorage. He says ice in the Bering Sea is at the lowest level since we've had satellites to track it, almost 40 years, and probably much longer. Part of the issue is just warm temperatures. Parts of Western Alaska and the North Slope, including the Pribilofs, Kotzebue, and Ukiagvik, are having their warmest winter on record.
So you have warm air running over record warm water. It's really hard to get sea ice to form in that situation.
Brett Schneider says the drastic drop this year might be an anomaly. He wouldn't be surprised if next year sea ice levels are higher. But he says the overall pattern is clear.
The trend line certainly is bad. And, you know, my interpretation of that is that, you know, this is going to be more likely than not in the years to come.
And that's left people like Ambrose Tawarik shaking their heads. Tawarik is a commercial fisherman in Unalakleet on Norton Sound. He posted a photo on Facebook of open water in front of town, something he also says he's never seen this time of year.
Everybody in the community is like, it's February. We shouldn't be hearing ocean waves crashing on the beach.
But you can hear those waves, like in this video, posted by Tawarik's friend Jeff Erickson, which shows waves rolling onto the shore. In a comment below the video, Erickson posted the lyrics to a song. In the words of an ancient sage, he wrote, "The times, they are a-changing." From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage.
Start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are changing.
Until recently, northern Alaska was one of the places that archaeologists weren't exactly in a hurry to dig. That's because the permafrost functioned kind of like a big freezer where artifacts could stay well-preserved until researchers got around to excavating them. Of course, that's changing. Permafrost thaw and coastal erosion mean that more sites are at risk of being lost or are already gone. And Alaskan archaeologists are joining a national conversation about how to confront these sorts of changes. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Ravenna Koenig has more.
Ann Jensen is an archaeologist who's lived in Utqiagvik for over two decades.
Working, moved up here in 1996.
We're walking into her lab in the Barrow Arctic Research Center on the far north side of Utqiagvik. Over the decades, Jensen has excavated many different sites across the North Slope. And increasingly, that work is becoming a race against the clock.
I mean, it's like burning down a library, basically. You know, if you see a library burning, you should at least, you know, try and get the rare books out.
In the Alaskan Arctic, several things are happening at once. One is that the ground is getting warmer, which means that eventually, frozen artifacts will start to rot. Another is that as sea ice disappears from the Arctic Ocean, the coastline of the North Slope is more vulnerable to storm damage, and that means that all kinds of archaeological material is disappearing into the ocean in big chunks. Jensen goes to a cabinet in her lab and takes out several artifacts, carefully labeled and sealed in plastic bags. One is a fish hook recovered from a nearby archaeological site in 2013.
Had we not excavated this in 2013, there was a storm in 2014 that took out not only where this was, but an 11 meters, or about 33, 34 feet, directly in from the bluff, was undercut and slumped and fell apart. So this would have all been gone.
It's lucky that Jensen got to these artifacts in time, because in a state as big as Alaska, she says there are probably thousands of sites that archaeologists haven't excavated or might not even know about. So what do researchers do? One idea is to change the way that research is actually done in places like Alaska. Jensen is part of a committee of anthropologists that are currently urging institutions like the National Science Foundation to fund a surge of documentation of what's there now and analyze it later.
Having a cycle that's just getting the data and getting it stabilized enough so it doesn't rot in the bags, you know, it goes off to the museum and is taken care of and then gets analyzed a little bit further down the road, ideally. You'll wind up with more data 50 years from now than you will if you just do normal science.
Another thing they're talking about is coming up with what they call a threat matrix, basically a way to help assess which sites are most vulnerable to climate change, which could then factor into funding decisions. Jensen acknowledges that there usually isn't much money available for social sciences like archaeology, but she hopes that the time pressures archaeologists are now under, not just in the Arctic, but in other places across the globe where coastal erosion and sea level rise are a problem, will spur more attention to the field. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Ravenna Koenig, Inuit Keavik.
Scientists have found an enriched uranium particle over the Aleutian Islands and don't know where it came from. In 20 years of aerial surveys, it's the first time researchers have detected a particle like this. And it's not naturally occurring uranium. It's the kind that might be found in nuclear bombs or fuel. Zoe Sobel of Alaska's Energy Desk has more on this mystery.
Dan Murphy wasn't looking for uranium in August 2016. He wasn't attempting to sample any radioactive material. He was looking into what particles are in the atmosphere as part of a global survey that could help people better understand air pollution and the climate. During the flight from Anchorage to Hawaii, Murphy collected thousands of particles, and it wasn't until he was analyzing the samples back on the ground that he realized what he had.
We have this mystery particle in which, you know, we have no way of making that we know about. Right now, it's sort of an interesting mystery.
The mystery particle is enriched uranium, the type of uranium associated with nuclear fuel or bombs. But Murphy says people of the Aleutians do not need to be worried about one atmospheric particle of uranium.
It's not going to change world politics.
The particle was so small that it can't even be seen with a small optical microscope. What Murphy can tell is that the uranium probably came from somewhere in Asia, but even using wind trajectories and particle dispersion models, he can't pin it on a specific country. And Murphy says this discovery won't change how he does his research.
This was rare enough that I don't know if I went out and did more flights that I would see another one.
Murphy recently published a paper about the particle with the hope that another scientist, maybe one who knows a lot about uranium, will help solve this mystery. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Northwest Arctic Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will discuss possible federal subsistence fish and shellfish proposals and other subsistence-related issues and invites public participation at a meeting February 28th and March 1st, starting at 9 a.m. at the Northwest Arctic Borough Assembly Chambers in Kotzebue. More at 800-478-1456. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station.
More than 4,000 Alaskans have experienced homelessness in the past few months. Thousands others have been on the brink. Due to an illness and a long hospitalization, Anchorage resident Dion Nguyen was on that edge but pulled himself back. Though it's just one success story, it affects the entire community. Ann Hillman with Alaska Public Media's Solutions Desk tells us why.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you doing?
All right.
Dion walks into a fast food restaurant, back on his feet. It's been about a month since we first met. He's a bit harder to track down these days because he's working full-time again.
How does it feel?
Great, because I can take care of myself. I can
pay my own bills and I can do what I need to do to take care of my daughter and my rest of my family.
Dion's still not totally in the clear financially, but he got enough help from Anchorage churches and a donation from his employer that his landlord is letting him stay in his home while he keeps working toward his foster care license.
I'm still behind, but she still let me go. So, you know, I'm still going to catch up to, you know, my obligations with my rent and all of that.
Now that he's working again, he can do that. And this outcome isn't just good for Dion and his daughter. Studies show that homelessness is expensive for the entire community. Preventing it is cheaper than paying for emergency shelters, soup kitchens, emergency room visits. Bran Wilson is with the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. He says once people become homeless, their needs multiply.
There's plenty of studies that show that once people do enter into homelessness, they have a negative effect on their own physical health, a negative mental health effect. Substance use increases.
But policy doesn't reflect that reality. Programs to prevent homelessness have been flat funded in Alaska for 10 years. Government money allocated for rental assistance usually runs out before the year is up and doesn't always go to the person with the highest needs.
In a lot of our systems, how they're set up, if you aren't calling at the right time, like if somebody called 20 minutes before you, that may be the last voucher that's available, regardless of whether the person who just missed out is in a higher state of need or not.
And the help that is available can be frustratingly hard to access. As Dion found out, the systems for distributing money and services are disjointed and siloed. Even people working in the field don't always know what's available. Brian says a better system would cut down costs and make it easier for people in need to get help.
It's really about working better together as opposed to the current system, which puts individuals like Dion in a situation where they have to shop for services and fill out paperwork after paperwork at provider after provider all over the town when they're in a state of crisis.
Now, advocates hope a solution for this is in the works. Communities across Alaska and the rest of the nation are testing out new coordinated systems where local organizations work together to help people get the support they need. It's the new national standard. In Alaska, one of the first steps was the creation of a database where different groups share information about people's needs and the available resources. With this new system, when a person seeks help, their needs will be assessed and they'll be helped from the beginning by someone who can coordinate the response across agencies. A system like that might have helped Dion avoid weeks of phone calls and appointments and might keep other people from falling through the cracks. But no matter what, the resources will always be limited. So Dion has some advice.
Save as much as you can for a rainy day because you don't know when things that happen in your life would occur that will make you having the situation that I had.
You can hear the rest of Dion's story and other ideas for preventing homelessness by subscribing to the Solutions Desk podcast or going to alaskapublic.org/solutions. From the Solutions Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Kids from around the state were in Anchorage this weekend competing in the Junior Native Youth Olympics, or NYO. KYUK's Johanna Yurick reports that these youngsters, nowhere near the age yet for the senior NYO, already exhibit the concentration of trained athletes.
Anyone will tell you strength is not enough. Skill, form, technique, and concentration will win the day in most sports, including the Native Youth Olympics. Those qualities were on exhibit all over the floor at the Wells Fargo Sports Center at the University of Alaska Anchorage this weekend. The two-foot high kick is a classic at the NYO. It can be done standing right under the target or with a running start. The trick is to jump off from 2 feet and kick your feet forwards and up to move the ball, and then land on both feet. Boys and girls compete separately, but at the end of Saturday's competition, neither sex had an advantage. Both girls and boys had made kicks up to 55 inches. That's way above the heads of these youngsters. 9-year-old Mason Logan Beanspoke from Bethel's Gladys Young Elementary School had to look up at the beautiful skin-sewn ball that was his high-kick target. After warming up in his gym shoes, he took them off. He stood beneath the ball, measuring it with his extended arms, then took 3 deliberate steps back and concentrated before making a running jump. He was one of the few who competed barefoot. He had thought that decision through.
Because that makes it lighter and you could kick higher. When you kick, it makes it way easier to kick without your shoes and socks on.
Mason didn't win the competition, but he came close. Stuart Towarek, one of the officials, watched. He was senior NYO 2-foot and 1-foot high kick champion when he was in high school. His 1-foot high kick still holds the record at 9'6". He says the youngsters competing in the junior NYO have a head start. He never even tried the traditional native games till he was in 7th grade. He says any one of the competitors he's watching today could break his record when they get into high school.
At a young age, you get them interested and it kind of motivates them to get better in all these events and maybe even go through high school. Some of these kids, this is probably their favorite event throughout the whole year.
It was just as true in Towarek's day as it is today. Everyone roots for everyone else. Even the opposing coaches are helping their competition improve.
I was telling him he was high enough and he needs to keep his head up, not down, and he'll kick higher that way.
When the struggling athletes succeed, the whole gym cheers. At the Junior Native Youth Olympics, I'm Johanna Urich.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Rachel Waldholz, Ann Hillman, and Johanna Urich in Anchorage, Ravenna Koenig in Utqiagvik, and Zoe Sobel in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
Join Alaska Public Media TV every week for Think Wednesday, featuring a dynamic lineup of programs exploring the thrilling world of nature, technology, and science. Think Wednesday explores the mysteries of our world and our universe, bringing the most exciting and inspiring stories that provide the answers that curious minds crave. Think Wednesday, every Wednesday beginning at 7 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV. One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.